order. It's 3:35. It is February the 10th, and we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Wagner, French, Co-Chairman Wilikowski, Senator Stedman, and Huggins. And we have three items on the agenda today. Senate Bill 242 by myself relating to geothermal resource tax credits. Senate Bill 243, also me, no royalty on geothermal resource. And then we've got an exciting presentation on the Point McKenzie Rail Extension. And so we're going to get through all three of those without haste. We will start with Senate Bill 242 and Mike Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Senator Liesl McGuire. Senate Bill 242 is an income tax credit for geothermal exploration and development. Geothermal is a clean, renewable source of power that provides and can provide an important baseload supply of power. It's been used in other countries and other states successfully, and we have some people here in the audience that will be able to explain and answer your questions about geothermal power as we get to it. What I would like to do, Madam Chair, is walk through the sections of the bill quickly to introduce you to them. Section 1 is the geothermal resource tax credit. This would be located within the corporate income tax statutes under 4320. And there are really two tax credits within this section of the bill. The first being on page 1 between lines 9 and 14 in subsection B. This would provide a resource exploration credit in the amount of up to 50% of the qualified exploration expenditures for exploration conducted on state land and 25% for those not conducted on state land. I have been talking to the Department of Revenue, Madam Chair, and the resource owned by the state and not owned by the state should actually be adjusted when we move the bill forward to reflect the land ownership. The important limit on that credit, Madam Chair, first of all, starts on page 2, line 1. That this credit under the geothermal resource exploration credit cannot exceed $20 million. These are capital intensive and large projects, and so that credit is capped at $20 million. The second credit is found on page 2 between lines 8 and 12, and this is the resource development credit. Once you move past the exploration stage and into the development stage, you again are accruing massive capital expenditures to build these facilities, and this is 10% of the qualified development expenditures. Both of these two tax credits are limited further by the subsection D, that the tax credit taken in either B or C of this section can never amount to more than 50% of a person's tax liability. So you're within the corporate income tax statutes, and as a company develops, brings the resource online, is accruing revenue, and then has a tax liability, these credits could offset that tax liability up to 50%. The key point being, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is that revenue would be coming into the state at the time. Now, we have been talking with some of the interested parties in this legislation, and it's important to note that on page 2, between lines 10 and 11, the carry-forward provision was limited to 7 years, and that would be inadequate to actually use the credit, and that actually should be more along the lines of 20 years, and that they will testify to that, and the Department of Revenue is here to answer any questions as well. Madam Chair, that is the basic gist of Senate Bill 242, is really to provide some tax credit incentives to help develop this resource within the state of Alaska. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Fish. We appreciate it. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a step in the right direction to encourage this sort of development. Just a few technical questions on the bill. In Section A and B, all throughout the statute, we talk about a person. And how is a person defined?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, if I could, I believe we have the Department of Revenue online, Joanna Bales, and if I could defer that question to her for a technical answer.
It's a good question. It relates to other subjects, huh? Joanna, could you answer that question? She's not on? Okay, she's not on yet. Who, is there anybody else here from the tax division? Okay, so we'll get back to that. There's a statute.
If I could, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm curious about is, is this tax credit available only per site, or is it per company? So if, let's say you have one company that's doing something in Mount Spur and then doing another one in the Aleutians, let's say, would they be eligible for two separate tax credits? Is it a tax credit per well, per exploration site? Could a company form two different units and get two separate tax credits? So that's sort of the direction I'm going, just trying to get the parameters on how expansive this will be.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'd prefer to have the Department of Revenue give you the technical answer to that. Through our conversations, my understanding is that the tax credit is based on the actual expenditures. And so the person being the company, if there were separate sites, it's the expenditure on which the credit accrues rather than the project multiple times. So it's linked to the expenditure. Yeah.
And then, if I could, Madam Chair, I have a couple other questions. And then, is this tax credit available when the resource goes online and into production, or is it available as it's incurred, even though the it may not be online for several years?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the tax credit is accrued, I believe, as the expenditures are made. However, since there's no tax liability, there's nothing to claim the credit against. It's in the income tax statute, so a company has to have income before they can have a tax liability. And so that's why the carry forward provisions are necessary, is to allow that to be carried forward until you're actually in the revenue generating and therefore income tax paying phase.
If I could follow up on that, is that credit transferable?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the credit in the current version of the bill is not transferable beyond a successive interest owner. So you could sell the credit if you sell the facility along with it. And I believe that is in page 2, sub 2 under D, lines 16 through 19.
And then I think last question, you have a date in here of June 30, 2008, and I guess just a little curious why we would make it retroactive a couple years if the goal is to encourage future development. I'm not real crazy particularly about retroactive tax credits. They don't incentivize development. I'd be curious to hear the rationale behind that.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, there have been companies that are working on geothermal projects in Alaska. To the degree of actual expenditures that have been conducted that would be creditable, I'm not sure, but it was to apply to projects that are currently under development. And we have people in the audience that will testify as to the necessity of these changes in the tax provisions.
And then one last one.
Yeah.
Sorry. Would these rebate tax credits be would they pass through ultimately to the consumers when the rates are set?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I defer that to the project sponsors to answer that question in terms of their understanding of whether or not they would be rate regulated. And if you'd like, we can also talk to the RCA about that issue, but wouldn't be willing on the record to promise something we don't know that would be delivered.
Okay. Or to refer to future bills that are upcoming about independent power providers, producers.
If I may, Madam Chair, just quickly, Senator Wilikowski, your earlier question about the transferability of this credit, I believe the project sponsors will talk about the transferability issue. That's been raised to them. And there is a question of whether it should be rebated or transferable, similar to oil and gas credits. It was not drafted that way.
Right, and Joanna is on the line, Senator Wilikowski. And Joanna, what the question first was person and how it's defined in Title 43. That's the first question.
Can you hear me there?
Yes.
Okay, for the record, my name is Joanna Bales. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division. Person under the Alaska income tax is defined as an individual, a trust or estate, a partnership, a corporation, that's the entire definition. So it does cover a gamut of different entities.
Joanna, if I could ask you, this is Bill Wilikowski. I'm just trying to understand the parameters. If we're giving an ultimately a $20 million cap, I guess I'm a little, just on the fiscal end, wondering if there were ways that this could be used to apply, you know, if you had multiple persons or multiple sites so that you could get multiple $20 million tax credits. I'm just wondering sort of what the parameters are, if we need to tighten that up or if it's fine as it is.
Through the chair, basically the way this language is written is that $20 million cap is per project. So if an individual taxpayer had several different projects, they could, in effect, get a $20 million tax credit for each project.
And not to sort of parse words, but when you say per project, if someone's doing a well at Mount Spur and they do multiple wells, or say wells that are several miles apart, is there a definition of project somewhere?
Yeah, through the chair, there is no definition within this language, and there isn't a definition in existing corporate income tax statutes. So the short answer is no.
Thank you.
Good questions. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering about the, you or Mr. Pawlowski, the difference between expenditures on state land and expenditures not on state land. We double the size of the tax credit, and I'm wondering what the philosophy is there.
Senator French, through the chair, I'd have to get a more detailed answer and get back to you on that one as to why. I'm a bit unclear on the different taxing relationship between state-owned land versus not state-owned land, and what other revenue, because it's part of an entire fiscal picture. And not to move off the bill, but there is a separate subject on royalties. So looking at the fiscal picture and the relationship, that's part of the philosophy, but I need a detailed answer for you.
If I could just answer the question. The point of the bill in multiple parts you'll see is to incentivize development on state lands. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what you'll see in the next bill when it comes to the royalty rollback as well. These projects, as they play out around the United States, there are opportunities in federal lands and opportunities in state lands, and we'd like them to be in the state land. And so we're trying to make every effort we can to incent more heavily the state land development.
And if I can just, for either my future education or someone else's, but I guess I've spent too much time on oil taxes, so I'm just thinking oil taxes, you know, state lands, we get revenue from that when the oil comes out of the ground. I'm not sure what we get from geothermal energy as it comes out of the ground other than cheap electricity, which I hope we get lots of, but the state isn't going to grab a royalty on that electricity, and maybe the future bill is going to tell me how it works, I guess I'm just trying to understand how if we want cheap power to Alaskan communities, I'm not sure any consumer will know the difference between geothermal from state versus geothermal from Fed. Maybe it should all be 50%. I don't know, but I'm just interested
Senator,
in what the thinking is.
Senator French, through the chair, if I can, there's Donna Vukchin online who is developing the NACNAC geothermal project for NACNAC Electric, and they are not on state land. And so she might be able later in the hearing to answer questions about the different fiscal regime she operates under. And I know that the people from Ormat that are in the audience will be able to give you a holistic picture of the fiscal regime under which geothermal is developed. And if I might further, Madam Chair, just to clarify, the definition in the bill is on page 2, sub 2, which is the qualified development expenditure, and that runs through page 3. The credits in the bill are on the qualified development expenditures. The project language is something we do need to work on. But,
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of concerns. I have a similar concern that was brought up by Senator Wilikowski, is retroactive issues, I think, are mm-hmm. rather dangerous. And I'm looking forward to seeing or hearing testimony from the industry showing that a credit is needed. So we're not trying to incentivize an area that's not needed. But the language under qualified development expenditures, I'm not sure if we shouldn't take a tighter look at that. I remember in the initial PPT work that was done, you're dealing with oil, it was for qualified capital expenditures qualifying under the IRS regulations. This appears to be extremely wide open for virtually anything, including for financial and legal services and so on and so forth, license permits, leases, it's just wide open. So I'm not sure that this doesn't cast too broad of a net. And I'd also like to have maybe some background work done to find out how many geothermal businesses are in the state, roughly, and how many pay taxes, corporate income taxes.
There aren't any operating in the state of Alaska yet. There are two companies that have been exploring, but there are currently no geothermal companies operating in the state.
Okay. So we can probably go over some of those grounds when we have testimony from the industry.
Just kind of a broad brush too on the two bills that you see before you, that if you recall last year, and I came back from Iceland and was looking at opportunities to incentivize and attract companies to Alaska to look at geothermal exploration and development. And what we did was we looked at a production tax incentive. That was the first methodology. Ormat, who's here, will talk to you. They came to town and have the Mount Spur lease. And then we started exploring what are the statutes on the book dealing with geothermal and what are the kinds of things that would make a difference to incentivize these companies to develop geothermal energy in Alaska. And these were the two bills that came out of those discussions that were during the interim. And the next one you'll see deals with the royalty itself, that potential issue. And then this, of course, as you recognize, is a tax credit concept for incentivizing through the various phases of development. But that's just a broader view. Yes, Senator Wagner.
How does this affect the Bernie's business at Chena Hot Springs? Does it have any effect? Or
I don't know the answer. I mean, we can find out. He doesn't operate in a commercial environment. I mean, Bernie has developed his geothermal resource for use of power in his operation itself.
He's developing it to supply power to the base. The second bell was so he could supply power and lay a line over the mountain to the base. So
well,
it is a commercial.
If he's formed a commercial entity and is going beyond just providing for Chena Hot Springs, then obviously he would qualify under this. So
I don't think he's done it yet, but it's in the works.
Yeah. And I also want to say that I recognize the concerns about retroactivity, and it's just a policy debate that we'll have in here whether to remove that date or not. We had the similar discussion in resources regarding the production tax credit, because in some of the places around the state there are already various renewable resource projects underway, and we'll have that similar discussion on that point. And it's not something that, you know, I'm wed to. I want the committee to decide from a policy point of view. Yeah, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Probably a question for revenue, maybe Ms. Bales, but if a geothermal company forms a joint venture with another company that has an existing revenue stream, could the geothermal company, or the existing company, start taking the $20 million credit long before energy is produced? And could they take a credit if no energy is produced?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, they could. And I suspect that the way that we have consolidated corporations filing, that very well would be the case.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Joanna. And Joanna will stay online to answer questions. Any further questions at this time? Obviously, Mike Plowski will stay in the room. Okay, then we'll go next to Paul Thompson from Ormat. And I also want to make it very clear on the record as well that these bills were not put in for any one company or any one entity. This was an idea, as I said, that I had last year based on a trip that I took to Iceland to see how geothermal energy had transformed that island nation in having a low, you know, 6 cents a kilowatt hour energy and what that did. So these are just ideas, and once again, just another concept to bring more energy to Alaskans. So with that, Paul.
Thank you very much. For the record, it's Paul Thompson. I'm the Director of Policy and Business Development for Ormat Technologies. With me is my colleague, Ram Orenstein, who is the project developer for the Mount Spur project and a Director of Business Development with Ormat Technologies. I want to start, obviously, by thanking the sponsor, Senator McGuire, your staff and the legislative staff for drafting these bills that remove significant barriers to geothermal development. And I'll focus on 242 at this time. And just want to start by giving you a little bit of background on Ormat Technologies. Ormat Technologies is a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange. We began as a company in 1965 designing and manufacturing equipment. Today, what separates us apart from your from other developers is that we are vertically integrated. We design and manufacture the equipment. We design and delineate the resource and operate the geothermal power plants. We're not new to Alaska. We did our first contract in 1975 with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, installing remote power units. And it's really been our dream to come back and develop a commercial-grade geothermal power plant ever since. In that time period, we've been responsible for over 1,000 megawatts of geothermal development in over 71 countries around the world. And we've been very interested in Mountain Spur and Mount McCutcheon and the geothermal resources in Alaska. And we think that the climate is right to kind of look at coming back and developing this resource to supply energy to the rail belt. We were honored in the recent AGA grant process when the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey cited Ormat as one of the most highly experienced companies in the world, and that the proposed stepwide approach is the best to move forward toward potential development at Mount Spur. That being said, we strongly support Senate Bill 242, which recognizes that geothermal exploration is similar to oil and gas exploration in the fact that it both involves high-cost exploration drilling that is not only capital-intensive but inherently risky. In several western states, substantial exploration drilling for geothermal resources took place in the 1970s and 80s. Unfortunately, that's not the case in Alaska. Many of the Alaska resources are what we call green fields, which require blind drilling and increase the cost and the risk. The state of Alaska has introduced tax credits for oil and gas exploration, and this bill looks to similarly incentivize geothermal exploration and recognize the importance of geothermal development and its impact on Alaska's goals for increasing its renewable energy portfolio in order to diversify its energy resources. If passed, our financial analysis indicates that this credit, if the carry forward is increased to 20 years, as Fish just explained, or made refundable, will lower the total cost of geothermal development by more than 10%, and therefore lower the total cost of power to the ratepayer by 5 to 10%. And we think that impact is significant in potentially lowering the price by a cent. And with that, I will conclude my comments and take any questions that the committee might have.
Great. Questions for the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, to the extent you can talk about it, I think this is a really exciting project. The particular good thing about geothermal is it's a solid baseline, 24/7. Doesn't matter if the sun's out, doesn't matter if the wind's blowing. So I think this is a very exciting project. Do you have timelines for when that you can talk about publicly for when you think you can we can expect this to be online? And then you mentioned about cutting the consumer's rates by a cent or so. How do you envision this passing through to the consumer in the way of lower rates? And can you talk publicly about what you expect those rates to be per kilowatt hour? Sorry, there's a lot of questions there, but
through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I think we can talk to that. The first question on timeline. Typically, we say to develop a greenfield geothermal project from defining the resource to bringing the power online typically takes 4 to 5 years. In Alaska, we're looking to extend that a little bit, but would look to have this project online by 2016. The second question on, I think, the impact of the ratepayers. When we look at a financial model, this reduces our CapEx. And so what's interesting about developing a geothermal resource is that there are kind of two issues. One, the cost to develop the project, and the price that we can get for selling the electricity. Unfortunately, we can't barrel up the electricity and take it out, you know, to source to the highest bidder or, you know, ship it far away. We've got to deal with the local market. That being said, within this local market, you know, we're looking at a fixed price area that then has to, what we typically do as an independent power producer is look for a contract with an investor-owned utility that is competitive enough that they can get that approved through the RCA. Prices in $2009 dollars, we are looking at, was it 10 cents? About 12 to 14 cents.
per kilowatt hour.
Per kilowatt hour. And that's, of course, to be negotiated with a utility or GRETC or an off-taker of that electricity. And so this would really allow us to start to bring down that price. And that translates to, if we need a lower price, hopefully the ratepayers would benefit from that through their utility bills.
And if I could, does that price include the cost of transmission lines into the main grid?
That price does not include, through the chair to Senator Wachowski, that does not include infrastructure costs to date.
So how do we get this tied into the main grid?
I guess the answer to that is we are going to be looking for solutions to the infrastructure costs. If we had to bear building the additional transmission to reach this project and the road, that would, of course, increase that potential the price we would need for electricity to make this project viable.
And you're looking at a 100 megawatt? Is that the sizing you're looking at?
We believe that the resource could achieve 100 megawatts. What we've learned in over 30 years of developing these projects is to be very pragmatic in developing them. Our first initial phase looks to be 50 megawatts. We want to develop that project, get the production wells up and operating, see how the resource reacts, and make sure that the permeability, the heat, and the water can sustain a full 100 megawatt development before we make that capital expenditure. So we're confident it can be developed to 100. We're going to start with a 50 megawatt project and build up from there.
Lastly, is the plan to add water to the process to create additional steam?
No. What's unique about Ormat's technology, which we've really been perfecting since 1985, is we have a closed loop system. What we do, there's really two types of geothermal development today, one called flash and one called binary. Flash technology is the first power plant was built in 1905 in Italy. And basically, you drill a well, the water comes up out of pressure, turns to steam, turns a steam turbine. That process needs Mother Nature to work in your favor. That steam needs to be recondensed, rain, recharge the groundwater table, and you hope to manage the reservoir through the forces of Mother Nature. Ormat system, being closed loop, and I think you have a diagram in your packet, we bring up the hot water under pressure in a closed environment and heat a secondary working fluid. That working fluid is what vaporizes for us. When it expands, it builds pressure and turns a turbo expander. The hot brine is then 100% re-injected back into the reservoir to then be reheated and reused. So it matriculates back across the hot rocks of the reservoir, gets reheated. And this is what makes geothermal development so unique, is the fact that we have a symbiotic relationship with the reservoir. We engineer and need to maintain the reservoir, because if we start to see a cooling effect, our power plant produces less electricity, becomes less economic, and we start losing money.
Great. Sure. Tell us just for a couple of minutes here about your Nevada plant and your Hawaii plant, how they're operating, and if you know what, how many cents a kilowatt hour they're at. What stories are there?
Sure. Through the chair to Senator McGuire. We've been operating a facility in Reno, Nevada that produces approximately 100 megawatts of electricity, and it's inside the city limits of the city of Reno. It actually produces enough geothermal to power to supply the entire residential load of the city of Reno. The project, being 100 megawatts, was built over a 20-year period, with incremental projects coming online utilizing one reservoir. So it really goes to the incremental approach of developing these projects. The prices have varied greatly over that 20-year period. I think, it's safe to say that the original prices we negotiated in power purchase contracts were in the 6 to 8 cents range, and today they're moving upwards closer to 10 cents. And I think what's a point to make here is, as we look to bring the Mount Spur project online rapidly, the value in doing so becomes exponential, or more important, when you look at a fixed price 20-year contract. What we typically enter into with a utility is a fixed price contract. So the earlier we get the project online, and the lower the rate we have to negotiate, is what we have to live with for the life of the project. So these projects that came online in Reno in 1985 at 6 cents really showed their value 20 years later. We hope that the same effect happens here at Mount Spur. The resource in Reno, Nevada is a unique geological resource from the basin and range, utilizing the unique geology surrounding the Sierra Nevada mountains. We have to drill very deep, and we find very moderate temperature water. So we have to use more water and volume to sustain the reservoir. Contrary to that, we've developed projects on the Big Island of Hawaii. It's a good project to point out here because it's also a volcanic resource. There we have a 30 megawatt project that supplies approximately 30% of the Big Island's energy needs. We developed that project as a volcanic reservoir, so it's very similar to what we would have here. It really helped us to define the science and help us in our techniques of how we would approach the development at Mount Spur. We've implemented safety protocols and standards of dealing with live molten lava and things like that, and are able to produce a product there that's very reasonably priced. In Alaska, the price is considerably higher because they are offsetting imported bunker fuel. And I think it's closer to the 10 to 12 cents, yeah, on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Thank you very much. It just sure. gives a kind of a flavor. Questions on that? Yes, Senator Huggins and then Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume that you mentioned two states that there are some federal incentives. Could you just give us a quick thumbnail sketch?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins. States that have federal incentives or states that have state incentives?
We have federal government. So the federal government likes your project and they have some tax credits.
Today, okay, I'll try to address both. Through the chair to Senator Huggins, today the federal government really only offers us a production tax credit, which is a 2%, two cent tax rebate on the project once it's producing energy. That tax credit, unfortunately, has been extended every 2 to 3 years or so. So it's very unreliable for us when we're doing our project finance to count on that credit being there when we start a project 5 years before it's going to produce electricity. That tax credit currently exists, and today under stimulus funds, we can actually forego the production tax credit and receive a 30% investment tax credit for projects online before 2012, I believe. 2013. And so our concern for this project is we don't know what federal incentives will be there when we're ready to bring this project online in 2016. Going back to states that we operate projects in, we've operated projects in the state of Nevada, California, Hawaii, and we've built projects in Idaho and Wyoming. And many of those states have tried also to incentivize geothermal development either through property or sales tax abatements. Or other such incentives. And while we don't like the impact to local governments that some of those incentives create, we think that looking at the corporate income tax as a way to jumpstart these projects is a great solution to that.
Yep, follow up, Madam Chair. This is exciting because, you know, it's kind of the future, and we're blessed to have some capabilities. Your international experience, I assume there's probably some international regimes that would be interesting for us to hear about, but one, if you could just describe one experience you had in an international, another country, foreign country.
I'd be happy to. Through the chair to Senator Huggins, I think, you know, the project that we are equally as excited to you as you to build a project in Alaska, and I think from an ORMAT perspective, we hope to look back at this in 10 years and say we were there at the, you know, creation or birth of the Mount Spur project, which is, you know, years from now developing many megawatt hours and also created an industry of additional geothermal projects to come online, you know, really trailblazing the way to not only develop these projects but the incentives needed to bring them online. And we hope that as we develop this project, what we learn from it will help lower the price for future geothermal projects that we develop in Alaska. An example of kind of trailblazing a good project for us is recently in Africa. Lake Naivasha, we've developed a geothermal facility in which we couldn't receive financing for the project because people were concerned about developing a project in a third world country. ORMAT took it upon itself to finance this project on its own balance sheet and bring this project to fruition. And today it's 48 megawatt project, which we then took to refinance afterwards. Part of this project we really improved upon the local community in teaching local people how to operate and conduct maintenance to the facility, and also looking at creating a schooling center for the children of those employees. And so today, it's really a pride and joy of ours in Kenya, this geothermal project, and it served again as a model for developing geothermal projects in third world countries that's been cited in multiple projects moving forward.
Senator Stevens. Any further questions? Thank you.
If I can, yeah, Chair, to Senator Wilankowski, on your question of kind of placed in service date, if I can, Ormat's position on that was, our original concern was when we received the leases for the Mount Spur project from DNR date back to 2008. If you took the place in service today, we would lose that initial investment of about $3.2 million for the leases, 3.5 to be exact. But in the total development phase of this, I think we wouldn't have a huge problem in modifying the placed in service date to current if that, you know, as we pointed out, we don't start getting the tax credit until we are generating revenue on this project, and the majority of that exploration cost is yet to come in this project. So I think from our perspective, we are also open to modifying that date.
I think maybe just in wrap up, the value of the incentives to your decision to continue moving forward with the project.
Through the chair, to Senator McGuire, these are actually absolutely imperative to moving this project forward. If we can't get the price in line with what the local utilities are willing to pay, it's really a non-starter for our project. And to expedite development, if we can get the see a credible commitment, I think, to these projects and reducing these barriers, it'll allow us to release the funds quicker to allow this project to, you know, be actualized by 2016.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski?
I love clean energy, green energy. I also like affordable, low-cost energy. And so are there assurances that that these tax credits will pass through to the consumers in the form of lower rates? I mean, do you envision the RCA regulating your end of the project, or do you plan on going to the say Chugach, who's I see sitting in the back, and then having them go to the RCA and having no RCA oversight over your project?
Through the chair to Senator Wilankowski, I think, I mean, we envision the second process where we look to get a contract with a utility, and that contract is then approved or not approved by the RCA. So when we're trying to define regulation of a, you know, private company, we want that contract to be transparent, and people can, you know, the RCA commissioners can see that price and decide if it's in the best interest of the ratepayers of Alaska. We absolutely, I mean, what's exciting and fun about working for a geothermal energy company is that we offer a base load, as you pointed out, a base load supply of electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we think that our price, while it might seem a little high compared to natural gas prices or coal prices in the lower 48, we offer something that none of those can, which is a fixed price over 20 years. And I think when you try to look for a price hedge on any other kind of energy generation over that time, that value is going to be realized. Not to mention, you know, current debates regarding cap and trade, renewable portfolio standards, and so forth. We've been giving away a lot of the intrinsic benefits of our energy for a long time. We think that those will be realized, and the price that we can look for in 2016 will become, you know, there are minds far smarter than mine going to, you know, analyze prices into the future, but we think a fixed price hedge is going to pay dividends for the ratepayers in Alaska.
And I think this is an issue that's we'll be discussing more in the future, but I would just say that the concern that I've seen, we have a similar process in place for natural gas in Cook Inlet, and we have no idea what it costs the producers to extract natural gas from Cook Inlet and sell it to a Chugach Electric or an MLP or other organization. And so it's something the RCA complains about a lot. It's very hard for them to evaluate what's fair and just when they don't know what the producers are it costs for the producers to extract. So don't need a comment. I know we have other business to move on, but I just from the ratepayers and South Central, it's an issue that I think about and wonder what direction we're headed in.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate it, all of your work and believing in Alaska. We like it. Okay, next we have Susan Lampson online from Naknek Electric. Susan, are you there?
Hello, my name is Suzanne Lampson, and I work on projects for Naknek Electric Association. Today my remarks will be very limited, and I will be speaking for Donna Vukic on behalf of Naknek Electric Association. I'd like to thank Senator McGuire for her work and all of the other committee members for their work on energy-related issues, and especially regarding geothermal. As you probably all know, we're working on a greenfield development in Southwest Alaska, and are getting our feet wet in the process. And Donna wanted me to make sure that you heard that we were in support of SB 242 and SB 243, and that removing the barriers to geothermal development through this kind of incentives is imperative if in the state of Alaska we are looking at renewables and geothermal specifically. I apologize. You'll have to defer your questions to Donna Vukic. And that's all I have to say at this time.
Thank you, Suzanne. We appreciate it. And we've heard from Donna before. We'll look forward to hearing from her the next time the bill is up. And appreciate your work. Okay, Marilyn Leland with the Alaska Power Association. Marilyn, are you there?
Hi, this is Marilyn Leland. Can you hear me?
We can. Good afternoon.
Thank you. My name is Marilyn Leland. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Power Association. And as I think all of you know, we're the trade association for the electric utilities around the state that provide power to more than 500,000 Alaskans. I'm going to be testifying on both Senate Bills 242 and 243. And I want to start out by saying that we strongly support both of them, and we've been working with the sponsor, Senator McGuire, and her staff on the bill. Alaska has the misfortune of having some of the most expensive costs in the country, expensive energy costs in the country, and the biggest problem supplying energy to our citizens. But at the same time, we also have the fortune of having what are probably the best resources for generating electricity in the country with hydropower, wind, and geothermal. We currently have one member, Naknek Electric Association, who you just heard from, drilling for geothermal, and several other members, including Inside Passage Electric Co-op, Nome Joint Utilities, TDX Power, who are considering the possibilities for geothermal. But the front-end costs are enormous, and the systems that are pursuing them are generally small. Without incentives, some geothermal just won't get developed because the companies won't be able to take the risk involved with that cost, and we think that would be a huge loss for Alaska. So to keep this brief, but in closing, I want to emphasize that geothermal is not a theoretical idea. It is a real possibility in Alaska, and the time is here now. So again, Alaska Power Association strongly supports Senate Bills 242 and 243, and we ask you to do the same as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn, and thank you for your work on behalf of all of the Alaskans that benefit from the energy that your organization oversees. So with that, I think we'll go ahead. Is there anybody else online that I overlooked wishing to testify on Senate Bill number 242? He's for the next. Anybody here in the audience wishing to testify on 242? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then we'll go ahead and close public testimony on that bill and set the bill aside and bring up Senate Bill number 243. The companion bill dealing with the royalty relating to geothermal energy. And we have Fish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Pulowski, and I'm the aide to Senator McGuire. If I could, I know we're relatively pressed for time, Madam Chair. I'll quickly walk through the idea in Senate Bill 243. Currently, under 3805181, the state of Alaska charges a royalty on geothermal, and this is subsection G of 3805181, of between 10 and 15% of the gross revenues from the project. So if you think about the royalty assessed on a geothermal facility, you're looking at the, what they said, the 12 cent or 14 cent fixed contract. So they're assessing a 10 to 15% royalty on the gross revenues of all that's been sold. Thinking about that and talking with the companies, and even with the Division of Oil and Gas, who oversees these type of issues, that has a significant impact on the economics of the project, Madam Chair. We've looked at other states and talked to the sponsors about their experience in other states, and other states don't have royalties anywhere near what Alaska has. These are royalties that are very similar to what we have for oil and gas development, not for geothermal development. And I think that was where the bill started off in concept. Procedurally, what the bill does is remove the royalty from geothermal projects in Alaska, that the state will not assess a royalty on geothermal projects. That's where it begins, is, and I think, Madam Chair, you can speak to your general intent in doing that.
Mm-hmm. And so this bill, again, as we took a stab at a production tax credit last year on geothermal, we didn't sit back and do that comprehensive look at how we had dealt with geothermal as a whole. And so we did that over the interim, and what we discovered is that there was an old reference to geothermal energy at a 10 to 15% royalty credit. And what we think we know about it is that it was put in as a placeholder back when the oil and gas provisions were being developed, but without any reflection at that moment in time on really what a regime that was appropriate would look like. We're dealing with hot water. We're not dealing with, in other words, a renewable resource, a renewable energy that is not extracted permanently in the way that hydrocarbons are. And so the thinking behind this bill is that what we want to do is incentivize these projects. So that's part of it. But the other is that we don't really see a rationale for the state to exact a royalty on a resource that is not being removed permanently from the ground. That's kind of the whole point of royalty and severance, is that we say you're going to take this up and export it out for permanent status. And so for the benefit of all the Alaskans, the future Alaskans that we have, we're going to bring in some revenue for it. So this is hot water. We don't see a reason why you would have it at that rate. And frankly, it's as was testified to, the highest, it would be the highest rate in the nation. And it would be a rate that would make any kind of geothermal development in this state impractical. In states that have federal lands aligning it, I just want to point out that some states have a 1.7% royalty amount, and the federal government has said 3% is their threshold. We'll let Ormat talk a little bit about it, but clearly the 10 to 15% amount would be outrageous. I took a stab at it, and the House has also taken a stab at simply saying no royalty for the reasons that I just articulated philosophically and constitutionally. But I'd like to hear testimony from the companies about the other royalty regimes, and then go ahead and set the bill aside so that we can get to our next presentation.
And if I may, Madam Chair, just for members, there's a briefing paper within your packets that talks to some of these royalty regime issues and does comparisons as well.
Great. Okay, and so with that, we'll call back up Ormat. We'll just run through briefly our list again for comment. Marilyn Lehman made comments on both, so we don't need that testimony, as well as NACNEC. So, Paul?
Thank you very much. For the record, Paul Thompson with Ormat Technologies. And I'd like to echo the comments just earlier heard that we recognize that the capital cost for development and construction of geothermal power plants in other states is typically around $4,000 a kilowatt. In Alaska, our estimates are 25% to 50% higher than that. We think that SB 243 recognizes that in other western states, geothermal power projects rarely are required to pay state royalties. I want to clarify this. When we were looking at this provision, we found that a predominance of western states actually do have a very high state royalty rate in statute. They just don't have any geothermal power projects paying that high statute. And so what we started to say was, why is this? There's a chicken and egg. State of California is somewhere in the 10 to 11 cent royalty rate for state lands. They are the largest geothermal producer of power in the United States, and a fraction of their projects sit on state lands. They have two examples, the geysers in Northern California, a 1,000 megawatt project, takes up a couple acres of state lands, and they pay the 10% on that, but when you look at total project costs, it's less than 1% of that state royalty that they are paying. They also have another example in Southern California. We compared that to a state like Nevada, which is the largest geothermal producer per capita, which does not have a state royalty rate at all. The state is 90% federally owned, so we tend to pay a federal rate. The Geothermal Energy Association, the National Association, which Ormat is also a board member of, explains that geothermal royalties vary depending on land ownership type and tend to range from 0.5% to 5.5% of revenues. And this is, the 10% is sometimes applied to gross revenues versus net. The majority of geothermal projects currently under development in the U.S. are on federal lands, where the BLM regulations call for revenue royalties of 1.75% for the first 10 years and 3.5% thereafter. Despite the fact that geothermal development faces greater financial challenges in Alaska, we think that the current statute royalty rate of 10 to 15% is simply cost prohibitive. Our financial analysis here shows that removing the royalty obligation will lower the kilowatt hour cost by, again, approximately 10% or 1 cent. And we think that removing the royalty obligations from geothermal power plants in Alaska will serve to acknowledge the unusually high costs of geothermal development and address even the AEA's concerns that the direct economic benefits of geothermal production are highly sensitive to O&M costs. And so unlike the bill we previously heard, this really looks to reduce the O&M costs once the project is up and operating and combat the high price of the remoteness of projects, the severity of weather, et cetera. And we think that this bill will ultimately lower the cost of clean, reliable power to ratepayers.
Questions? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Would you support an amendment that said that any reduction in royalty was required to be passed on to the consumers in the turn in rate reductions?
Through the chair to the senator, I think we want to evaluate that language closely, but I think in principle we'd absolutely support that.
Great. Further questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and set the bill aside so we can get to our Point McKinsey presentation. And do we want to take a brief at ease then to get set up? We'll just take a brief at ease. Resources back on the record at 4:35, and we are delighted today to hear a presentation on the rail extension project in Point McKenzie. So without further ado, want to get on the record, John, and tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and we are delighted to be here to brief you on the Point McKenzie rail extension project. We have a series of presentations for you today. And for the record, my name is John Duffy, Borough Manager for the Matanuskas Assistant Borough. We have a series of presentations for you today, and in the interest of time, we're going to abbreviate that because we know you have a very busy schedule. We have Mayor Maystrom here with us today, who will provide an overview of the entire project, why it is important to the state of Alaska, because it is indeed a project of statewide significance. General Gamble, CEO of the Alaska Railroad, is online to answer questions. We have Dr. Paul Metz, from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who has done all of the background research that identifies the commodities that would be moved over the rail line. Dr. Steve Colt from the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research, who's identified a number of jobs that will be created by the project, and in particular, the jobs that would be created in the South Central regional economy and Anchorage specifically. And then to wrap up, we'll have former Commissioner Joe Perkins talk about the importance of the project itself. Just as a general overview, we believe this project offers tremendous economic opportunities to the state of Alaska. The studies that we have done, and they've been done by independent third parties, University of Alaska, Northern Economics, what have you, identify that the project will create thousands of jobs, have payoff to the state treasury in hundreds of millions of dollars over 100 years or more, and truly does begin the diversification of Alaska's economy, provides the opportunity to create major manufacturing opportunities such as the production of cement. Indeed, we find that we could supply 5% of our nation's cement needs with this project. And with that, I will turn it over to Mayor Maystrom.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Madam Chair, my name is Rick Maystrom, and I'm former mayor of Anchorage, and I am now working on behalf of the borough on this project. And I got involved with the Matsu Borough. We built a second home out in the valley after we had debated among Arizona and Hawaii and Southern California, and we chose Wasilla for our second home. And they thought anybody who was that good at decision making, you know, we need to get them working for us. So Wasilla became our new second home, and we love it out there. And I've really gotten to understand. I've gotten to meet the political and business leadership out in the valley, and I've really start to understand now the relationship between the economy of Anchorage and the economy of the valley. They're very closely tied, and as goes one, so will go the other. My other business is primarily apartments, and that's sort of pertinent here in that I've been buying apartments in Alaska for 30 years now, and most of our buildings are in Alaska. We have some in Arizona and some in Colorado, but most of our buildings are in Alaska from Kenai. We have a number of units down in Kenai, a number of buildings down there, I think 5 or 6, and mostly in Anchorage and Eagle River. And my job with our business has been to really understand and predict the Alaskan economy. We make our money by understanding what's happening in the economy, when it's getting stronger, when it's getting weaker, and that's our goal. And I say that because it's important to understand that in the last 35 years, there have been 3 times when the economy has started to slide, when the state of Alaska's economy has really started to slide. One time was after the conclusion of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline in 1979. The pipeline finished, and the workers were done, and a lot of them moved out, and the work was done, and the economy started to slide. But at that point in time, Governor Hammond had just been elected in 1978. He had beaten Wally Hickel in a close Republican primary and beaten Chancey Croft, and he was reelected for governor. And his focus and the focus of the legislature at that time was to get jobs out into this economy that was losing jobs quickly from the private sector. And they created a capital budget, and I'm not suggesting this process, but they created a capital budget that allowed for $1,000 for every person in Alaska, for every person in Alaska for 3 years for capital projects for the communities. So every community got a chance to put forth its its suggestions for capital projects, and there was $1,000 a year for 3 years. And I can speak to what Anchorage did because I was on the assembly at that time in Anchorage, and I understand what the impact it had on Anchorage and on the Alaskan economy. In Anchorage, we built $34 million Sullivan Arena, $32 million Egan Center, $16 million museum expansion, $44 million library, and what was going to be a $27 million performing arts center, but it turned out to be $72 million. And we didn't know that the architect was dyslexic and the accountant was dyslexic until after that happened. But $72 million performing arts center. But more important and more related to what we're doing, we also built the extension of Minnesota that went south on Anchorage out to O'Malley and allowed for that development out there. And that on a small scale is what I want to talk to you today about. But what happened, though, the second time the economy started to slide, in 1986, when the price of oil dropped from $30 down to about $8 a barrel, it started to slide. And at that point in time, the new governor, Governor Cooper, who was just elected, saw that happening. And the legislature at the time, but the governor saw it happening and said, boy, things are getting bad. The economy is starting to slide. We better save our money. We better hold it in. We better pull it in. And they did. And they had very little capital expenditure during the next 2 or 3 years. And the economy fell off the biggest cliff that it had ever seen in Alaska, I think, in the last half of this
century.
Thank
you, Senator French.
Point of order.
Sure.
Governor Cooper or Governor Sheffield?
Governor Cooper. Governor Sheffield, Governor, let's see, this was 1986.
I thought Governor Cooper was the oil spill.
He was Governor Sheffield. Hammond's last term ended in 1982. Governor Sheffield won right after Governor Hammond. And then in 86 it was open. And Terry Miller, 82, just a little historically. 82, Governor Hammond's term ended, and Terry Miller ran against Tom Fink in the Republican primary. Tom Fink won, and Governor Sheffield beat Tom Fink in 1982. Yeah, in 82. Right, and then 1986, Governor Cooper won. Sheffield was only one term. Yeah, the fall of 86, and so he had 87, 88, 89. So he was there for the oil. He was the oil spill governor, but he was elected in 86. So as you get older, you start to remember all these things that you thought were current history, and you turned out they're more than current history. They're old. So thank you. But he was elected in November of 86, took office in January of 87. And his reaction was to pull in the spending and not spend at all, because he was afraid the economy was going to get bad, and in fact it did get bad. Anchorage lost 13% of its population and 25% of its assessed valuation, and the rest of the state had the same thing. And so the third slide that I'm seeing in the economy is right now. This is the first slide that we're looking at in our business and saying, we're in for 3 or 4 or 5 tough years. We're expecting fewer jobs the next 2 or 3 years. And in general terms, I would encourage the legislature to use capital spending now because it's cheaper, there's more availability of the workforce, and to use that to help stave off this drop until Chuck GC or the gas line or whatever happens is going to happen. But this is the time to do that. So with that said, Madam Chair, I'd like to get into the specifics of this project. And this is one of the projects that can make a big difference. And this is a rail extension from Port McKenzie to the main line of the Alaska Railroad and its impact on Anchorage, Matsu, Denali Borough, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and the Alaskan economy in general. Right now, there's a time that I think the legislature needs to be thinking about capital project, and it's a time of uncertainty. And I don't know if it's best for the group to turn around, or can you guys, so there isn't a screen there. Okay, we have uncertainty right now in energy and availability cost. We have uncertainty about the gas line construction, uncertainty about the future of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We're down to 600,000 barrels a day. Uncertainty about Small Business Administration rules for contracting programs for Native businesses. And there is no scenario in that set of discussions that are going on right now in Congress that would be good for Alaska. It's just a matter of how bad they'll be for Alaska. It could be just a little bit bad for Alaska, could be pretty bad for Alaska, or it could be really bad for Alaska. But I don't see any scenario where something good is going to come out of this for Alaska. There's also uncertainty about the exploration permits for the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea. There seems to be some progress, but there's still uncertainty. And like the stock market doesn't like uncertainty, and neither do investors in a given economy, in a regional economy or state economy. They don't like uncertainty. There's interest, there's people talking, but the uncertainty is very bothersome to people. There are two things that are certain. One is we have lack of transportation infrastructure. We don't have the kind of transportation infrastructure we need to allow the economy to develop on its own. And the other thing is certainly a lack of diversification of the Alaskan economy. We've been talking about that for a long time, and we have a project that we think can help with that. And so one of the solutions to that is the project that I'm going to talk about, and the effects can happen as soon as next summer. Now, on the slide, I'd like to actually refer you to this slide if I can. This is the, thank you. There's Anchorage, there's Port McKenzie, and you'll see three options, three yellow lines going up here. The middle line, this line right here. Those are three options for the extension of the rail line from Port McKenzie to the main line of Alaska Railroad. And the main line of Alaska Railroad is this line going around here, of course, in north on to Fairbanks and south down to Seward. One of these three choices will be recommended by the Surface Transportation Board, part of the EPA study that's going on right now, and that recommendation should come in March of this year. That will be a draft recommendation, then there's 60 days of hearings, and then a final recommendation. And then we'll know where this line is going to go, where it can go. And if you looked at this line all the way forward, you'd see that what it does is from this point on, from up by Willow on, it reduces the length of the number of miles to Tidewater by 147 miles. So coming from Fairbanks, it's 147 miles closer to Tidewater. Coming from all those potential mines in the Denali Borough, 147 miles closer to Tidewater, and that makes a huge difference. So understanding the impact, you really have to look at all four of these areas, Fairbanks, North Star Borough, Denali Borough, and Mat-Su Borough, as a regional economy.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, Senator.
And what would be the impact to Anchorage if we start shipping everything to Wasilla, to the port? We're spending a lot of money trying to upgrade the port there, and of course we have a railroad yard there. I mean, what would be the impact there?
Very positive. Number one, the ports are very different, as I'll show you in my presentation. And what I guess I would like to do is, if I can I answer that question as soon as I finish, because I'm going to talk about how it would impact the port. So that's okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, my apologies. Senator Wagner.
The 147-mile figure, from where to where?
From any place north of Willow to Tidewater. So from, say, from whether it's Fairbanks.
147-mile difference.
147 miles difference. 147 miles closer than it would be to Seward.
Okay, to Seward.
Okay, to Seward, yeah.
That's what I was trying
okay.
to get. Yeah.
Okay, which is the main tide, you know, main Tidewater access. Sorry. Thank you, Senator. Okay, just briefly, I'm going to tell you what it does and then explain how it does it. It opens up the interior to resource development. It facilitates the development of world-class limestone deposit in Livengood. That there is a lot of interest in developing that if they can get it to Tidewater inexpensively. That would be north of Fairbanks. It facilitates the development of cement production plant in and around Fairbanks. It opens up about a 60-mile corridor along the rail belt to exploration extraction of strategic missiles, including lead, zinc, copper, molybdenum, and silver. And it improves, importantly, the transportation of lower-cost fuel and low-sulfur fuel to the interior and southwest Alaska. It's a lot cheaper to get that in there from that port than it is from the areas that it's going to right now. It improves the competitiveness, the world competitiveness of Alaska coal by about $3 a ton, which is the same amount that it would decrease the cost of any aggregate that's coming out of that Denali North Star Borough by about $3 a ton. And it reduces transportation and staging costs for the gas pipeline construction. And Exxon and the Denali project have been expressing a lot of interest in talking and asking questions and wanting to know all about this. They believe that it will save about $100 million in the transportation and staging costs of pipe for the gas pipeline. And right now, the pipeline, if you read the paper the other day, the pipe coming up for the Liberty Field to get from Japan, that pipe comes up through, it's shipped from Japan to Houston, goes by rail from Houston to Seattle, it goes by barge from Seattle to Whittier, it goes by rail from Whittier north. That's what has to happen now to get pipe. Because there's no, the port of Anchorage isn't deep enough, there's no place to store it, there's no place to put it there, so that's how it's getting there. And now it could go straight there. So it's very important if it does go. If it doesn't go, this and other projects will be absolutely essential.
Senator Wagner.
Senator. Why does it go that route versus going directly into Seward and up the railroad?
You know, you've got to talk to the Liberty people who are doing that, but that's the route they're taking. You know, I don't know how, you know, why it's not going to Seward first, but it's going to Houston first, and then it's going to be barged. Yeah. So, and part of it, I don't know if the, you know, I don't know the answer to that, Senator.
Must be treated in Houston, so.
Okay, now let me go on to the real key parts of this presentation on Port McKenzie. Port McKenzie is very different from Anchorage. Port McKenzie is a bulk commodities port for mineral, cement, coal, fuel, and bulk fuel, and it's not a consumer goods port or container port. The Port of Anchorage will always be the most important port in Anchorage, and it's a port that focuses just on consumer goods, on containers. It's a roll-on, roll-off port. And this will not replace it in any way. There's no way that this port is going to be doing containers or consumer goods at all. And Anchorage will continue to supply about 80% of all of the interior Alaska's, and including Anchorage, of all their commodities. So the Port of Anchorage is going to be really key. And I'll talk a little bit about the two ports and what their accommodations are in just a moment. This is a slide that shows in the lower right-hand corner. This is the Port of Anchorage, this banana-shaped area out there. Just to the east of that is Government Hill. To the east of that is the western part of Elmendorf. There's Eagle Glen Golf Course. There's a western part of North Mountain View, and here's downtown Anchorage. You can see the difference in size. This is 14 square miles that Port McKenzie has of industrial area, industrially zoned area, with no competition for, you know, there's no residential there, there's not going to be anything there that's going to prevent the industrial development of that area. So there's a big area, and Anchorage just doesn't have that. We can't...
Wait just for a second. I know when we had this presentation from Siri on their underground coal gasification project, mm-hmm. they mentioned multiple times that they were trying to stay this side of the Mat-Su Borough line because of taxation issues. And I'm curious, and maybe even could look to Senator Huggins, but just an update on what's happening, if at the local level those competitive issues have been addressed.
Yeah, it's really about power generation and you know, a delay factor that the permitting process, and the borough manager can speak to that, but the people that are in that business, to include MEA, thinks it's not a friendly environment to be able to build power plants.
The Siri actually owns the land in this industrial area, is owned primarily by the Mat-Su Borough. Okay. Siri also owns some of the land there, and they are very supportive of this. And the University of Alaska Trust owns land there, and they're very supportive of it also. So that's what the ownership of the land is. Okay. This is Port McKenzie 20 years ago. Here's Port McKenzie 2 years ago, and this is just actually low profit wood chips being shipped right now, or low volume wood chips being shipped to Korea. But it shows a conveyor belt taking it down, putting it on the ships, and that ship's heading to Korea. This is a good slide that really illustrates, Mr. Senator Wilkowski, the difference between the two ports. This does not compete with the Port of Anchorage. It is a this port has a 60-foot mean low tide. The Port of Anchorage has 35 feet mean low tide. And so they're limited, and the ships that are coming into Anchorage were designed to be able to come into that port with a 35-foot mean low tide. And when you get to the kind of ships that haul aggregate and minerals and what can be hauled out here, they can't come into the Port of Anchorage. ultimately, I think the Port of Anchorage and Port McKenzie will be sister ports, and maybe in the long term there may be a common port commission that supervises both ports, and probably the railroad would be included in that. So there could be one port commission, one port authority, rather, I think, that handles all those ports. So I see it as a very cooperative relationship, and the railroad is very, very supportive of it, and Pat Gamble, who's president of the railroad, I believe is online now and can speak to it later on. To help understand the difference in the two ports, Port McKenzie can handle what are called Panamax vessels, and Panamax vessel is the maximum size vessel that can get through the Panama Canal. It's a wonderful name. I love the descriptiveness of that name. It's a Panamax vessel. A Capesize vessel is bigger than a Panamax vessel. A Capesize vessel is a vessel that can't get through the Panama Canal and must go around Cape Hope or Cape of Good Horn. Or Cape of Good Hope, not Cape of Good Horn. That's an even larger vessel. Port McKenzie can handle the largest ships in the world. They can handle those Capesize vessels. And so it's a great opportunity for those ports just 2.5 miles apart to have the deep water materials coming in and going out of there, and the shallower, more consumer-oriented, roll-on, roll-off container materials coming out of the Anchorage port, which gets them into the city of Anchorage very, very easily into the interior of Alaska. It also handles barges carrying bulk commodities, minerals, coals, and aggregate. This port, by the way, in an effort of cooperation, is showing gravel being taken over to the Port of Anchorage for the expansion of the Port of Anchorage. Here is some projects that are going on right now. This is an expansion. This 8.2 acres right here is an expansion on the barge dock area that will take place this summer. And this area out at the tip of it is, that's the deep water portion of the port. And this little square pad, you could probably park about 20 or 30 cars on there. It's much bigger than it looks. But this is going to be expanded. This is a pad right now. It's going to be expanded all the way out to here. And the next slide shows that. This is the expansion. This is that little square pad that you saw on the last slide. And this is the expansion that's going to be built out there. It's got the environmental permits. It does not have the funding. That's part of the funding that we're looking for. But everything's ready to go, is permitted and designed and ready to go. And what that will allow is to allow heavy tractor-trailer trucks to come there, to go straight here, not to have to turn around and come back and get back onto the road system here. So it'll make the loading and unloading much, much easier and very straightforward and efficient. Here's the first slide that talks about what we're doing right now. This is an area that is the rail loop. This rail loop is being built right now. The groundwork was done this summer. And this is a 100-car rail loop. And the construction is underway. The groundwork is being done. And 100 cars is very typical of heavy aggregate cars. The 100-car trains has been the standard in America for quite a long time. The trains will be able to completely circle around, no backing up, no other problems like that. And then this will go forward into one of those three site selections that the Surface Transportation Board will select in March. So there will be major conveyors right here that the loads will come off the train, be able to go right onto ship down here. This is going to be expanded, as I just said here, and this is the barge area that will be expanded down there. I have this slide on just to illustrate the area that Exxon and the Denali project has been very interested in pipe storage and pipe preparation and assembly. The pipes come in 40-foot sections. They'd be welded into 80-foot sections. They'd be coated. They'd be loaded onto 90-foot cars, 90-foot rail cars, and brought north to the highway. And they'd be trucked to wherever they're needed for the construction of the gas line. So this is the area that they think is important. Their own conclusion is it would save about $100 million in the cost of the gas line just to be able to bring the pipe in there. There's things going on right now over there. This is a warehouse that's just been completed, 24,000 square. These are some of the road construction that's being done over there. If you haven't driven out there in the last 2.5 years or 2 years, probably a year and a half, you would have driven out on a dirt road, And you probably don't drive out there because it's a full 2 hours drive out there, 2.5 hour drive from Anchorage out there. But you won't have to drive very long, and I'll show you in the next slide why not. We also have a 1,500 bed prison that's going on right now being constructed, of which I think about 20% of the employment of the employment force will be from Anchorage. The reason that you won't have to drive it much longer is that the ferries will start. This is the MV Susitna. It's being constructed in Ketchikan. It's going to be christened in March of this year, next month. It'll be christened in Ketchikan. And it's got about 9 months worth of sea trials, and then it will be turned over to the Matsu Borough for a run between the Matsu Borough and Anchorage and Kenai and Tayonek. It holds 20 cars, and the revolutionary thing about this is that the cars are driven on the lower level, and then it's hydraulically lifted. And so that middle part of the ship never touches the water, and the pontoons become the icebreaker. So it's the first high-speed icebreaking ferry that's ever been built by the Navy and turned over to the Matsu Borough for years of testing and record-keeping. Here's some project history down in Ketchikan, and it's being built in Ketchikan. And one of the things the Matsu Borough required from the Navy is that it be built in Alaska. And that was negotiated here two or three years ago by Borough Manager Duffy in the legislature. Here's another progress shot, and then here's another progress shot of the borough. And this is about a year and a half old, so it's almost ready to be put in the water, and will be put in the water in March. Here's the route, and this is important. You can see it's going to go every hour on the hour between Anchorage and Port McKenzie, or every hour. I'm not sure if it's going to be on the hour, but once an hour between Anchorage and Port McKenzie. Also, it will be going to Tayonek, and also makes the access to Kenai quicker, faster, and with more ability to carry goods to Kenai. So I think it's going to help all three of those areas when that ferry starts.
Question?
Yeah.
Yes,
Senator.
Where in Kenai is that going to dock?
That's the same thing with the same issue we're working on in Anchorage. We're working on an Anchorage area for the dock and a Kenai area for the dock. But I don't, John may have the answer to that.
Nikiski.
Okay. Now here we have, this is the ferry terminal that's already built and constructed on the Port McKenzie side and ready to accept passengers and go from the Port McKenzie side. And then once again, before I get into the last slides, this is the key slide, and that is the rail loop that's being built. There's a road here. Ultimately, there'll be another road built over to this rail loop. So it can be trucked on or off. It goes down from here down to the tidewater. And with that, you start to understand why it can open up the interior to resource development. There's been a number of studies done by Paul Metz, who's here, done by HDR, done by Northern Economics, that talk about this transportation is what's necessary to allow the development of limestone deposits of zinc, copper, molybdenum, and silver in the interior. And it can make a significant difference in the economy of that area. I've talked about the improving the world competitiveness of Alaskan coal and the importance of reducing the transportation and staging costs for the gas pipeline. And now let me talk about the last one, that is the employment in the Matsu Borough, Denali Borough, Fairbanks, North Star Borough, and Anchorage. On the project segment, the short term, the rail extension construction related jobs between 2010 and 2013, there are estimated to be 3,000 jobs, direct and indirect construction related jobs. The Port McKenzie portion of that project would create 500 jobs, so about 3,500 jobs in that area. For the Anchorage delegation, that would be about 720 jobs from Anchorage and the balance from the Matsu Borough. And I think, as you all know, Anchorage is very much the center of engineering, architectural firms, finance for all of these projects, as well as a source of construction jobs that will be easier because of the ferry. So there'll be a lot of jobs being created in Anchorage because of that. One of the things that I was surprised to find out is that the Red Dog mine and the Pogo mine, half of the employees at Red Dog and Pogo live in Anchorage, and they go week on, week off. And was
Red Dog and Pogo, John?
Yeah. Half of them live in Anchorage, which really surprised me. But they work week on and week off. In addition to that, and most important, is the private development this will accommodate. This will facilitate private development of jobs along the rail line because of the mining up there, and also the industrial development of Port McKenzie, which is 14 square miles of industrial area that is going to become a big part of Anchorage's northern industrial segment, and is going to help both Anchorage and the port. And as I said, and these are estimates by HDR and Institute for Social and Economic Research, and I see the ports being very cooperative. There are two different ports for two different purposes with two different depth levels and two different facilities for accommodations. And they'll be a wonderful, very much like the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach work together, but they're a little bit differently. And I think that they're going to be healthy for both ports. And they're certainly going to be healthy and significant to job development in this area. Where we are right now with it, the first part of this, the completion of the environmental impact study, $10 million, that will be done March for the draft report. The construction of the road and the rail bimodal loop, that's under construction right now. And that's an additional $17 million, which we have in hand. And then the permitting design and the beginning of construction for the selected alternative is the next step. And to keep this going and to keep it developing, that's what we're looking for this year from the legislature, and that is $57 million to continue that project. And the final project, the construction of the railroad bed, the cost of that will depend on which of the routes are selected. And then the laying of the tracks and could be completed by 2013. So in summary, I'd just like to say thank you very much for the chance to talk with you. I think it's a great economic development project that can make a big difference long term, and in the long term, make for a healthy, more diversified economy for Alaska. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mayor Maestrom, for your continued leadership. It's really nice to see people who have been leaders in our state stay around and continue to use their institutional knowledge to move our state forward. And I want to say a special thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if the railroad has looked into bonding this?
Let me ask: Is Pat? Can I ask Pat Gamble if he's on the line?
He was on the line. Let's see.
Pat, are you on the line?
General, are you there?
Okay, I think he's not. John, do you want to?
Wendy, do you want to?
Can you help answer that question? I know, or.
You want me to?
Sure.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Oh,
there's the general.
Yeah, general. Thank you very much. Senator Wilkowski, would you like to ask that question?
I'm just wondering about the ability of the railroad to bond this program.
Senator, actually, the legislature gave us the pre-approval in a previous piece of legislation to bond for this program.
And is that, are you planning on bonding for it, or?
We have not reached that particular financial decision point. It was a pre-approval in case that turned out to be the best way forward at the time, and that has yet to be determined. But the statute requiring legislative approval has been fulfilled in the sense that we do have the pre-approval, and having that in our hip pocket, it's a lot easier to go out and find out which vehicle is actually going to be the best one for the state to use.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. General Gamble, thanks for being with us. Charlie Huggins here. Could you just give us a quick burst on what the mission of the railroad really is besides just being a railroad?
Senator Huggins, that's a great question, because when this project first came up, we huddled and asked the same question, which is typically what we do because we're in the business of economic development. The Corporate Act has four policies of the state that it basically defines the railroad, and three of them are in the development area of resources, transportation infrastructure, and economic long-term growth. So this project is right down our alley.
Yeah, thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, the general's still on the line. General, it's my understanding that the bonding authority that you have is revenue bonds, which are really not practical or realistic for this project. Am I wrong?
Well, at the time, if you recall, we were trying to do two things at once, and one of them was to pre-approve the Agrium project and then also pre-approve potential bonding for this project. So using the Railroad Bonding Authority, now which specific type of bonds, I can't tell you off the top of my head because I don't remember the exact language, but it was clearly intended that the tool be considered and to be used as appropriate.
Okay, I recall that there were revenue bonds, but I
it would not be recourse to the railroad. Some sort of a conduit bonding.
Okay.
Senator Wagner.
What's the average cost of constructing each mile of railroad right now?
That cost is actually going up and has since I normally used to advertise around $5 to $7 million a mile. I would say that probably the band is somewhere, depending on the geography that you're trying to build across. And then with the good fortune that interest rates and cost of commodities and goods have come down, we're probably still in a band between about $5 and $8 million a mile.
So $5 to $8. Second question. Right now, with your existing line between Fairbanks and Anchorage and the traffic you have on it and the freight you haul from both Yucabelli and then on north from the oil refinery and then intermediate trains for tourism, et cetera, how much more traffic can you put on that railroad line before you had to do modifications to it?
Senator Wagner, the good news is the modifications are just about done on that line. Anticipating the pipeline, we began some in earnest about 8 years ago with rebuilding that particular section of line. We upgraded and sped up the rate at which we were doing it when we came to the legislature and got permission to actually issue $165 million worth of bonds. They're like Garvey bonds. Our federal formula funds pay the debt service, and we accelerated the building from Anchorage to Fairbanks, the rebuilding, to include the bridges, the sidings, upgrading signalization, and technology. We probably sped that whole project up by 10 years. We've got three more years to go to complete it, and it will be completely done from Anchorage to Fairbanks and modernized. 40 miles in 2010, 40 more in 11, and finish it off with 20 and 12, and we're done.
Thank you.
And by the way, the capability or the amount of traffic that we're hauling right now is a fraction of what the capacity of that line will be able to move when and if the time comes.
Thanks.
Any further questions for the general, or the mayor, or Mr. Duffy? Okay. Then hearing and seeing none, thank you so much, and thank you, Senator Huggins, for his leadership in getting us to take time out of our day to listen to this, and appreciate your testimony. It was good. It was really interesting. I appreciate it. Okay, so we're adjourned. That's great.